Dear Jesus, may I enter into the eternal divine order of God to place my absolute nothingness in the heart of the Most Holy Trinity, to give to my God the joy of fulfilling the purpose of my existence by doing all the acts of my life through the Immaculate Heart of my Mother Mary and in the divine will of God. And in this same manner may I live, pray, act, eat, walk, sleep, and do everything. May my soul be devoid of any other longings, wants, or desires, and may you, my beloved divine will, do with me whatever you want or desire. All I ask is that you bind me to your most holy will so intimately that I may never swerve from carrying out what I know to be your good pleasure, and that I remain so docile to the movements of your divine will that you never perceive even a breath of resistance in my soul to your requests of me. Come, divine will, with all the angels and saints, especially my sweet Mother Mary, to touch my forehead, to imprint on it the Holy Spirit, and infuse in me true light, so that I may understand the truth and the good that are in these writings and prayers. Amen. So I want to begin tonight with November the 14th, 1926. And in the first paragraph, Louisa asks Jesus a question. I mean, what would happen if I didn't do any acts for a whole day? It's very interesting, his response. She says, I was doing my usual acts in the divine volition and I thought to myself, if I spent one day without doing these acts, what would be the good that I would lose and the evil that I would do? Now, that's not actually a question she needs. That's a question that's been given to her for our benefit. In other words, you know, we've met this before in earlier volumes, that the Lord puts thoughts and questions in her mind so that she will ask questions that we ask. And this is one of our questions. And Jesus replied, my daughter, do you know what you would do? By not doing your acts in my will, you would lack the reflection of all creation. Now, the word reflection is going to be used in the next couple of messages as the echo or the counterpart, what God is looking for from us, the response he's looking for us, or the mirror image that he's actually looking for, because he's trying to have a living creation inside of us, mirroring the creation outside of us. So he says we would lose that, we would lose the reflection of all creation. And because you would lack this reflection on that day, the heavens would not extend within you. The sun would not rise within you. The sea would not flow within you. Notice the within you all the time. The sun will rise outside in the sky and the sea will flow outside in the earth. But the reflection of it is not going to happen inside of you because you're not letting it happen. The earth would not let a new flowering bloom, nor would the joy, the music, the singing of the inhabitants of the air, the sweet symphony of the spheres be heard in you. My will would not find its echo in you. Now, its echo and reflection, they're the same thing, the way it's being used in the text. So it wouldn't find its echo or reflection in you. And therefore, the divine will would feel the sorrow that on that day, the little daughter of its volition has not given it the requital or the response of a heaven for love of the divine will, because she lacked the reflection of this heaven. She's not made the sun rise in return for its eternal light, nor has she let the divine will hear the sea flowing, nor the sweet murmuring, nor the darting of the mute inhabitants of the waves. My will would feel all of its acts, the reflection of its works, missing in you. Now notice, we completely are the loser. Totally. In other words, if we don't do the acts in the divine will, we're not giving God a chance to do what he wants to do in us. And it's our decision. We can't blame anybody. So we'll be missing in you. Nor could the divine will form its echo. Now, echo is being used, as I say, as reflection as well. It's being used in the same context. It wouldn't find its echo in you. All of its acts, the reflection of its works or the echo of its works, would be missing in you. Nor could it form its echo in you. In other words, it actually has no material to work on, if I can put it that way. When Jesus wanted to multiply bread for 5,000 people or 7,000 people, he asked that somebody would give him material to work on. And we've already seen, in particularly in studying volume 30, that our acts are the material that he actually works with. So if you don't give it to him, he can't work these prodigies within us. So the divine will in its sorrow would say, "Ah, today my little daughter has not given me a heaven as I have given her one. She's not given me a sun, a sea, flowers, singing, music and joy as I have given to her." In other words, there's just no response to God's love coming towards us. And so the love coming towards us in creation has not gone back. The circle of love has not been completed. So there's a void. So therefore, she's gone out of my likeness. Now, we've been told from the very beginning that what God intended was that his own likeness would be in us. That's Genesis 1:26-27 and Romans 8:29, that Jesus wants to restore us to God's likeness. Her notes have not harmonized with mine. I have loved her with many manifestations and with incessant love. That is from the beginning. But she didn't. So I've loved her with everlasting love is Jeremiah 31:3. "See what you would do," he said. "My will wouldn't tolerate this in you, its little daughter. It wouldn't tolerate the void of its works." So if you really are living in the divine will, if the deed has been done and the gift has been given, he wouldn't tolerate it. Because it would be blocking the outflow and the continuous movement of love coming from God to us. So in the second paragraph, he tells us that we need great graces to actually live the divine will. And I think if you have your own book, this really needs a VIP on it. Okay. On hearing this, Louisa said, "My Jesus, my love, may it never be that I give this sorrow to your adorable will. You will help me. You will give me more grace. And I will be more attentive in order to receive this reflection, this echo." Now, you see the way they're used interchangeably there, which your holy will produces in the whole of creation so that you can get the response from me. They always use the word correspond when we would say respond in English, so that I may respond to you. We say correspond if it's sort of letters in the post. Respond is the response we give. So Jesus resumed his teaching and he said, "You must know," this is very, very important, I couldn't underline this enough, "you must know that great graces are needed." In other words, this is not some kind of a decoration. This is a major transformation that happens in us. "Great graces are needed in order to form in the soul the sanctity of living in the divine will." This is a massive work of God. He has been telling us that for a very long time. The other sanctities, that is the sanctities associated with the fiat of redemption as distinct from the fiat of sanctification. The other sanctities can be formed with small graces because it's not an immense and eternal will that they must embrace and possess. So they're doing God's will to the best of their ability with the grace that they have received in their era before the revelation of the divine will. And they are so pleasing to God that heaven is peopled with saints. So it's not an immense and eternal will that they must embrace and possess, but only particles of it. Little particles of it. Tiny drops. They only take little particles of its commands and its shadow. Now, since that's all they're capable of, you can understand the extraordinary mercy that the Lord shows to all of our relatives and friends and everybody we know throughout the earth. And those of us who have the privilege of praying in the divine will can ask for this immense mercy. And in the events that are coming on stream for us right now at this point in time, there's a great need for us to actually ask the Lord in the divine will for this infinite mercy to be given to all of the people who can only take its shadow or tiny drops of the divine will. On the other hand, in this sanctity, they must possess my will. That's a different matter altogether. That's literally a different subject. It's a different world. And they must possess it as their own life. That means that the divine will is actually running this life that you're looking at here. The human will has actually surrendered, and the divine will is actually running it. That is resurrection. This is major stuff. They have to possess my will as their own life. And they must form the cortege or the companions of the divine will. And they must make its acts their own acts. These are divine acts that they make their own. Therefore, seas of graces are needed in order to form this kind of sanctity. And we know from elsewhere in these writings that Jesus has told us we need all the seas of graces that he has provided from his life and from Blessed Mother's life and from Louise's life and from other people who have lived in the divine will. We need all the help we can get because we're tiny little people being raised to an absolutely extraordinary sanctity. And he says, my will must actually bilocate itself. Bilocate means to be in two places. Bi is two and locus is a place. So bilocate, he's going to have to be in heaven and he's going to have to be in our hearts as well, in two places. So my will must bilocate itself in order to extend its sea in the depth of the soul. Now, he's going to make it perfectly clear. It's all his work. We actually surrender. We give him the space. We give him the material with our acts. We give him the surrender of our will. But he actually alone can actually bring us to this state. So my will must bilocate itself in order to extend its sea in the depths of the soul and then extend another sea of itself so as to be able to receive what benefits this sanctity. He has to be the giver and the receiver. So that its unending light and its immensity without boundaries, in order for that to actually be expressed in some way inside of us, he has to do everything. He has to make everything possible. It is literally not possible to anybody else. The goodwill of the soul is nothing other than the bottom of this sea. In other words, we give him the ground, or as he says elsewhere, the field or the space to move. So all we do is give him the bottom of the sea. He is the sea. And he is the immensity, and he is the light, and he is the sanctity, and he is the life, and he is absolutely everything. And I am absolutely nothing except one who agrees to let him work with me. So we give him the bottom of the sea, which forming the shore surrounds the waters in order to form the sea. You really, really need to look at that. It's wonderful stuff. So in the next paragraph, Louisa talks about what God does in order to enable us to live in the divine will. So this is terribly important stuff if you're teaching anybody. So Jesus continues, my daughter, it takes much to sustain and preserve a divine will in the soul. Now, he alone knows the extent of our sinfulness. He alone knows the extent of our weakness. He alone knows that he can't trust us. He alone knows that. I don't think, unless we get an enormous grace from him, that we will ever be able to touch the depths of our sinfulness and inability in his presence. We probably wouldn't be able to take it. So it takes much. And the divinity, knowing that the creature doesn't have the equivalent things for a will so holy, he holds nothing back. This is all his work. Everything is placed in her, at her disposal, in order to form the sanctity of living in my will. So that's the first thing he tells us. Everything is placed in her. In other words, God does not leave us without the ability to actually live this life. He does everything. He wants it so badly, he will actually do all the work. God himself acts as the prime actor and the spectator, what I call the giver and the receiver. And Jesus said, my humanity gives everything. That is the whole fiat of redemption. He gives everything that he has done for us. He holds nothing back. Everything that the divine will did and suffered and conquered, which are endless seas as help of this sanctity. So really, we've no excuse, because everything is given to us. As St. Paul says, what have you that you have not received? So you can't boast about it. The third thing is that the Queen Mother herself places her seas of grace, love and sorrow at the disposal of each one of us to give us help. And she feels honoured that they serve the supreme will in order to accomplish the sanctity of the eternal fiat in the creature. Okay, so we have Jesus and Mary completely active in the soul that wants to live in the divine will. We are quite literally children of Mary. And this is going to come up in more of the messages as well, that she is in heaven holding many empty places for the real children, the children who will live in the divine will. So she's prepared to do anything to help as well. Heaven and earth want to give, and they do give, because feeling all invested by this will, they desire, they yearn to help the fortunate creature to fulfill the purpose of creation. So what does heaven and earth actually want? They want to fulfill the purpose of creation. So when a creature on earth is willing to cooperate, they will do everything to help. So we will lack nothing. And therefore, Jesus says, you will lack nothing on the part of your Jesus. Nothing. More so, since it is my desire from of old. Now, first of all, from of old means ab aeterno. But he's going to tell us as we go on in this sentence, it also means the 6,000 years since Adam. Since I've wanted this, he said, from the very beginning. That's your Jeremiah 31:3 again. I've loved you with an everlasting love. And I've waited as long as 6,000 years. That's since the fall of Adam. Wanting to see our image reproduced in the creature. So that's Romans 8:29. Paul says it very clearly. So I'll let you look that one up yourself. So they want to see their image reproduced in the creature. And he says we want our sanctity expressed, not just a human goodness. That belongs to the era of redemption. We're moving into a different era. And so it is a divine sanctity that has to be impressed. He says we want our will operating. We want our works exposed in her, and we want our fiat fulfilled. And all of that is divine. And therefore, the three divine persons have to be operating in us. That's why he says he bilocates. He is in heaven and he comes to bilocate in us as well. And he continues, I wanted the enjoyment and to take the pleasure of seeing our reflector or image or echo in the creature. That's 2 Corinthians 3:18. You become like what you worship. Otherwise, the creation would be without delight, without amusement, without harmony for us. In other words, God would get nothing out of it. But God's going to get something out of it if he succeeds in impressing this divine sanctity and enclosing their divine works and having the divine fiat fulfilled. They will get something out of it. Our echo would not find the way, he said, through which to resound if this doesn't happen. Our sanctity, the place in which to impress itself, our beauty, the place in which to shine, our love, the place in which to pour itself, our wisdom and mastery would find no place in which to operate and unfold. So all of our attributes would be hampered. Okay, let's stop there for a second. When you're looking at this afterwards, go back over those two sentences and you'll find that what he's saying is that when the divine will bilocates in us, what must actually come out of us is God's sanctity, God's beauty, God's love, God's wisdom, and all of his attributes. That's what has to come out of us. That is what's going to change the earth, not words. And again, I remind you of a statement of St. Francis of Assisi to his men during his lifetime when he said to them, go out and preach the gospel and speak if you have to. You see, when all of this is operating in us, the transformation that's going to happen in us will be such that people will have to see it. And it will be so attractive because its beauty, it's order, it's love, it's wisdom, and it's all the other attributes. That would make you an extremely attractive person to others, unless they were completely evil. So all of our attributes would remain hampered if you don't do this, he said, because they would not find the suitable material with which to form their work. Now, we have to give the suitable material, which is our surrender, our trust, our faithfulness, and all that he's asking from us. Okay, so we give him the suitable material. Again, to me, that is the offertory of the Mass. Our sacrifice is that we lay our will on the altar, and the suitable material is the gift of our will to the divine will. Like the little piece of bread and fish that was given to Jesus before the multiplication of the loaves. So they wouldn't find their suitable material with which to form their work so as to have their reflector. In other words, God needs to see himself in us. We become a mirror of him, like a parent looking at a child, seeing themselves in the child. On the other hand, in the soul in whom my will reigns, my will disposes her to become suitable material. Now, in my book, that's coloured. And the reason why it's coloured is most of us are not suitable material when we begin. And so when he sees cooperation and attentiveness and faithfulness in us and our attempt to let him reign in us, he makes us become suitable material. That's why I like it. It's wonderful. So it doesn't matter if you're not the greatest thing starting out. You don't have to be. So he says, so that our attributes may carry out their delightful crafting. They, three divine persons, want the sheer joy of being allowed to work in us and transform us. And we have to give God that joy. So let's go to November the 16th, 1926. And the first thing we meet with in the first paragraph is that the human will blocks all this. So if we know what he's trying to do, then we will see the seriousness of the human will blocking it. And he says it's the human will that makes us blind. That's very, very interesting. In other words, he names what makes people suffer from spiritual blindness. So Louisa said, my usual state of abandonment in the divine will continues. And at the same time, I call on the one who forms my happiness, my life, my all. So she used to do that with an awful lot of words in the lower volumes. And now she just simply states that she does it. She doesn't give us a lot of reading on it. And then Jesus comes. And Jesus said, my daughter, the more you abandon yourself to the supreme volition, the more you advance. It's actually that simple. So it's extremely important to fuse ourselves as often as possible, day and night. When you get up in the middle of the night, make sure you fuse yourself, that you stay in that active position with the Lord. And for those of us who are older folks, getting up at night becomes a habit, and you might have to do it two or three times. It gives you a chance to keep on clicking into the divine will and the fusing all the time. And it means that the prayer is actually continuous for the 24 hours. That's one of the advantages of age. The more you abandon yourself in the supreme volition, the more you advance along its ways. Okay? So the more you abandon yourself, the more knowledge you acquire. Now notice, if you don't abandon yourself, you're not able to take this knowledge in. And there are plenty of people who are stumbling over various aspects of the knowledge. All they've got to do is turn around and surrender to the Lord. Because the more you surrender, the more the knowledge will actually sink in. You'll actually realize what you're looking at. So, and the more you abandon yourself, the more you take possession of the goods that are in the divine will. So how do you take possession of the divine will? Abandon yourself. And I gave you an image already, that the best image for me of abandoning yourself is a child in its mother's arms. And it's Psalm 131, my soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. Happy and contented in that relationship. So first of all, he tells you how to do it, how to actually take possession of the divine will. because in the divine will, there's something to know and to take always. There will never be a point in which there isn't anything to take, because we're dealing with an infinite person. We're dealing with an infinite will. We're dealing with an infinite reality. So there's always something there. We know this ourselves. Here we are studying volume 20. But if you go back and look at earlier volumes you have studied, they come across as fresh, as if you had never read them before. Because what the Lord says is full of life and full of depth and full of nourishment. So there's always something to take. Being the primary inheritance given by God to the creature. Now, the primary inheritance, the one that was given with the creation of Adam, was the gift of the divine will. He wanted the human race to live in the divine will so that they could be the lords of the earth. It was given by God to the creature, and possessing the eternal goods, my will has the task to always give to one who lives in the divine will. So if we're living in this inheritance, and if we reach out to possess the divine goods, divine will keep giving, because he wants us to live in our inheritance much more than we do. And only when it finds a creature within the boundaries of its volition, in other words, living in the divine will, not doing your own will half the time and then doing a few acts and then going back to your own will again, and then doing a few acts and then going back to your own will. And that is vacillating between two different eras. No, that's not going to do it. So when it finds a soul living within the boundaries of its volition, then it is content and it begins the activity of its office. Now, if you're having your own book in your hands, would you write the word in the margin, begins? He really only begins this extraordinary transformation when we actually surrender. If we're in and out and in and out and in and out, dipping our toes in, that's not it. Then it begins its divine office. And putting itself in feast, it gives new things to its heiress. Now, the scriptures are full of information about us being the heirs to God. Now, I'm going to give you a few references. I actually found 100 of them, just to let you know it's all over the scriptures. So I'm going to give you Romans 8:17. James 2:5, Acts 20:32, Matthew 25:34, enter into your inheritance is what you read there, 1 Peter 1:4, Hebrews 1:14, Colossians 1:12, and 1 Corinthians 15:50, just to let you know that this business about us becoming heirs to God and to Christ is exactly what the Lord intended in creating us. It's all over the scriptures, but I've just given you New Testament references there. So the soul who lives in the divine will is the feast of my will. But the other side of the picture is those who live outside of the divine will are the sorrow of God. So we can either give joy to God or sorrow to God, depending on whether we're living in or out of the divine will. Because the ones out of the divine will put the divine will in the inability to give. That's the important thing. That we're doing it. We're closing the door. And that's why you have this marvelous statement in Revelation. Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." It could be Revelation 3:23, something like that. I just haven't looked it up. We can put the divine will in a position of not being able to exercise its office. And we can put the divine will in the position of not being able to fulfill its task to do all that he has just been saying to us in these messages. More so, since each act of the human will is a veil that the soul puts before her own eyes, which prevents her from seeing with clarity. Now, this is going to explain our society out there today. It prevents her from seeing with clarity what the divine will is and the goods contained in it. And since most of the creatures, certainly today, live continuously in their own will, they form so many veils as to become, very charitably, he says, almost blind. And you'll see that when you read the Gospels, Jesus was very, very anxious to open the eyes of the blind, because that's what he wanted to do with the human race, enable us to see God. So they become almost blind to knowing and seeing my will. They become blind to their choicest inheritance, which was supposed to render them happy in time as well as eternity. So most people he describes as being in the position of the prodigal son, Luke 15. Oh, if creatures could comprehend the great evil of the human will and the great good of the divine will, they would abhor their will so much as to lay down their lives in order to do mine. And I think if you watch the progression in these writings of Louise's own journey, when she began to grasp in some way the enormity of the difference between living in the divine will and living outside of it, she began to really fear doing her own will. So in the next paragraph, he tells us that the people who are living in their own will are slaves. The human will renders the human race a slave. It causes him to be in need of everything. He feels strength and light missing in him continuously. His existence is always in danger, and whatever he obtains, it is by dint of prayers. Now, you need to add something here. What this text is talking about is prayer of petition. It's not talking about the prayer of union, which is the murmuring of love and all the other things that we do in the divine will. So these prayers are prayers of petition, what I call gimme. I want this, I want that, I want the other. So the man who lives out of this divine will is a true beggar. On the other hand, the one who lives in the divine will has no need of anything, because they possess the divine will, which is the source of all goods. He has everything at his disposal. My will gives him the dominion of himself. Now, that is a fantastic statement. It's fantastic. Because we're king of nothing if we're not king of ourselves. If we don't have self-mastery, we have mastery over nothing. And self-mastery is the very first thing. And you have to have a good bit of self-mastery before you get into the divine will, because the divine will is the crown of sanctity. My will gives him the dominion over himself, and therefore he is the owner of strength. We become strong interiorly. Now, even if you read the historians, they will tell you that the strength of a nation is the moral fibre of its people. And look at the weakness that's in the world today, because there's no moral fibre there. They've given up God. They've given up the Ten Commandments. They're living in their own will. They're wallowing in sin. And we see leaders that are not fit to be leaders. We see nations who have no idea why they're even in existence. And so God has to use chastisements to wake them up. It's amazing. So the thing you will notice, therefore, about somebody genuinely living in the divine will is this inner strength, this moral strength. And the person also has light, because the divine will is light. This person is enlightened. This person is not floundering. And it's not a strength or a light of human strength or human light, but of divine, because the source is the divine will. His existence is always secure. And since he is the owner, he can take whatever he wants, nor does he even need to ask in order to receive. If a fish is in the ocean, it actually doesn't need to ask, where's the water? The water is everywhere. If we're in the divine will, we don't have to ask in terms of petitions. It's there available for you. This is so true, he said, that before Adam withdrew from my will, prayer did not exist. That means the prayer of petition, because he had everything. And that number one is meant to be an indication of a note saying prayer of petition. It is need that makes the prayer of petition arise. And he did not need anything before the fall. He had nothing to ask for or to intercede for. So he loved, he praised, he adored his creator. And that's what we do in the divine will. Love and praise and adore and make reparation for others. The prayer of petition had no place in the terrestrial Eden. That's very important. The prayer of petition did come, it did arise after sin. Because after sin, Adam needed everything. After sin, the prayer of petition became an extreme need to try and get around the heart of God to provide for us. Because when you read Genesis chapter 3, God told Adam and Eve the earth wasn't going to cooperate with them. So they were in a position of great need. After sin, the prayer of petition is an extreme need in the heart of man. And when one prays, it means, that's prayer of petition, by the way, it means you need something. Because he hopes and he prays in order to obtain. So he wants something. So he asks and he hopes. On the other hand, for one who actually lives in my will, he lives in the opulence of the goods of his creator. And he lives there as the owner, not as a guest. And if he or she feels any need or desire, seeing herself in the midst of so many goods, it's that of wanting to give her happiness and these goods to others. So those who are in the lower sanctities, who are operating in the human will, they're in need of everything, and prayer of petition is a very big thing for them. Someone actually living in the divine will, they don't think of themselves. They're not asking for anything for themselves, but they are very concerned about God's glory, and they're very concerned about the salvation of others. So their prayer and intercession is to try and get as many souls as possible to come back to the Lord, at least in the lower sanctities first, and then finally in the divine will. So the movement is entirely outward. In the lower sanctities, the person's movement can be, doesn't always have to be, but it can be inward. In other words, I want to save my own soul. So the movement is outward, it's other-centered. So there's another key to check that we're on the right path. As the true image of her creator, there's your Romans 8:29 again, one who has given so much to her with no restriction at all, she would want to imitate him by giving to others that which she possesses. So she has so much. That is the origin of her mission, that she wants to reach out to others. She wants to give life to others. She wants them to know as much as possible about what God wants to give them. And she will do what she can to try and enable the others to come into this place. That's literally the origin of our mission in the divine will. Oh, how beautiful is the heaven of the soul who lives in my will. It's a heaven because God dwells there. It's a heaven with no storms, no clouds, and no rain, because the water which quenches her thirst, that fecundates her, fertilizes her, gives her growth and likeness to the one who created her, is the divine will. In other words, the water means the most basic need of living. The jealousy of the divine will, so that the soul would not take anything but of its own, is so great that the divine will does everything. It does literally everything. If she wants to drink, the divine will makes itself water to refresh her. And while refreshing her, extinguishes all other thirsts. And this is very, very important. It does a double thing. It refreshes the soul itself, but it takes away the desire for anything else, so that her only thirst will be the divine will. If she's hungry, the divine will makes itself food, which while satiating her, takes away from her the appetite for all other foods. Now, notice the satisfying of the soul's need on the one hand and the purification on the other. The purification goes on all the time. If she wants to be beautiful, the divine will makes itself brush, in other words, the artist's brush, giving her brush strokes of such beauty that my will itself remains enraptured at a beauty so rare, impressed by the divine will itself in the soul. So there you have the divine will actually serving the soul, as Jesus served his apostles at the Last Supper, washing their feet in the humblest possible gesture you could even imagine. But there you have the divine will doing for this very graced soul everything that Jesus did for others when he was alive. So the divine will is literally serving the soul. If we don't respond to that with absolute nothingness and utter adoration, I just don't think we understand. The divine will must be able to say to the whole of heaven, look at her, how beautiful she is. Now, in earlier volumes, we have come across Jesus saying that to the heavenly dwellers about Louisa. It's a much, much bigger thing to say it about us. It is the flower, it is the fragrance, it is the colour of my volition that you see that is so beautiful. Now, notice different aspects of the divine will operating in us. Notice the flowering, the fragrance, the beauty that's there. And of course, it's all divine order as well. In sum, the divine will gives her its strength, its light, and its sanctity. And because it is given by God and it is divine, therefore this soul can do what other souls can't do. And everything is to be able to say that she is a work fully of my will. And therefore I want her to lack nothing. I want her to be like me and I want her to possess me. I mean, what do you call privilege? That's the ultimate in privilege. Look into yourself to see the work of my will. Look at your own acts invested by its light and how they have changed the earth of your soul. And therefore, if we're really living in the divine will, we have to be able to see these changes inside of ourselves. Everything is light which arises within you, he's talking to Louisa, and turns to wound the one who invested it. Therefore, the greatest affront I receive from creatures is not to do my will. Isn't that interesting? And for that sentence, I want to give you John 3:19-21. It's because of their own sinfulness and their own choices that they have rejected the divine will. Okay, so in the last paragraph of this message, Louisa is shown what I think is World War II. So I want to give you Amos 3:7. The Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. After this, Louisa said, he transported me outside of myself, making me see the great evil of the human generations. And resuming his message, he said, my daughter, look at how much evil the human will has produced. This is 1926. We're a century later, and I think things are much worse. They've so blinded themselves that they are preparing fierce wars and revolutions. This time, it will not just be Europe. That's why I think it's World War II. But other races will unite together. The circle will be more extensive. Other parts of the world will participate. How much evil does the human will? It blinds man, it impoverishes him, and it makes him the murderer of himself before he becomes the murderer of anybody else. Because we know that about murder, that if you kill somebody else, you've killed your own soul first. But watch this. The whole world joined together in this battle. But I will use this for my highest purposes, Jesus said. God can write straight with crooked lines. And I will use it as the reunion of so many races that will facilitate the communication of the truths. In other words, that the human race would really become one, as it has with modern communications. We have people all over the world talking to each other in the same session as right now. We discover that we're the same. It doesn't matter what part of the earth we're living in. So the result of this ultimately will be, and I say ultimately, it hasn't happened yet, is that the human race will discover we are all one family and will unite. But unfortunately, Satan is going to move in and do it his way first. And we'll have the Antichrist reign first. But God intends to use it for his highest purposes, so as to awaken the human race to the fact that we're all one family, so that they dispose themselves for the kingdom of the supreme fiat. So opening up the world to become one family and one race and all uniting together will actually facilitate the new era, because it's happening all over the world at the same time. And with each person coming into the divine will, I see it as the church rising from the dead, soul by soul, one after the other, that the living stones are actually being raised. And it's all over the world. It's all at the same time, because we're all the one family. It doesn't matter what colour we are, what culture we are, what language we speak, or anything else that seems to separate us. So the human race began as one family, and I think it's going to end that way as well. So the chastisements that have occurred are nothing other than the preludes of those that will come. Now, this is a century ago, and the preludes of what are to come are for us in our generation. How many more cities will be destroyed? How many more people buried under the ruins? How many places buried and plunged into the abyss? The elements will take the part of their creator. So in other words, creation will rebel, as creation is rebelling now. If you go to a program on the internet called The Angry Earth, you will see just what is happening all over the world that is not being reported by the communication systems that we have. It's absolutely amazing. Imagine snow in Arabia. Imagine a flood in the Sahara Desert. Go to it and see just what's actually happening. The chastisements have already begun. So here Jesus says in 1926, "My justice can bear no more. My will wants to triumph and would want to triumph by means of love in order to establish its kingdom. But if man doesn't want to be met with love, then God will have to use justice." Notice it's our choice. And while he was saying this, he showed an immense brazier of fire coming out of the earth. And those who were near it were invested by that fire and disappeared. I was left frightened, and I pray and hope that my good Jesus will placate himself. That must be some kind of a volcanic eruption. Okay. Now, it's almost 5 to 8. I'll have to go over the time if I do the next one with you. Is that okay? This is actually a very important message in November the 19th, 1926. But it follows the last one so completely, I wouldn't like to leave 3 or 4 weeks between the last message and this one. Because in the first paragraph of this message, Jesus speaks about the fact that the human will keeps the divine will crucified on the earth. So my beloved Jesus, drawing me into his adorable will, made me see and feel the painful conditions in which the ingratitudes of creatures put him. And sighing with sorrow, he said to me, "My daughter, the pains of my divine will are unutterable and inconceivable to the human nature." Before I even go on, I want to remind you that since we came into volume 20 particularly, Louisa had been talking about going through agony and pain that was beyond description, that it was on a completely new plane to anything she had experienced before. And Jesus always gives her a taste of something that he wants to explain later. And I think he's explaining that he gave her a taste of the agony of the divine will. "My will," he said, "is in all creatures, otherwise they wouldn't exist. But it is in the nightmare of a terrible and harrowing agony. Because instead of giving the divine will dominion and let it carry out its life in them, it keeps it repressed. Giving the divine will no freedom to act, to breathe, or to palpitate." Now, if you remember Louisa meditating on Jesus in his mother's womb, in that little book, Our Lady in the Divine Will, she speaks about him not being able to move, breathe, or anything else, which seems very unusual for an infant in the womb. And maybe there's a connection about the agony of the divine will that he was already experiencing. So the human will acts, the human will breathes freely, the human will palpitates as it wants, while mine is there only to serve. Now watch this, this is extremely important, that when we are serving ourselves, we turn God into a servant, because God has to keep me alive. God has to supply everything for me to survive. and therefore we turn him into a servant. And so that will give you a new way of looking at John 13, verses 1 to 10, Jesus acting as a servant for his disciples. So that turns the divine will into a servant to contribute to their acts, because we can do nothing without the divine will working with us, and to remain within their acts, agonizing and suffocated by the rattle of the agony of long centuries. My will writhes within the creatures in the nightmare of an agony so harrowing, and its writhings are the remorse of conscience that they have. In other words, the agony of the divine will in the depths of our being actually produces the remorse of conscience, which I find very interesting. It produces the disillusions that people experience. It produces the setbacks. It produces the crosses. And it produces the tiredness of life. And it produces everything that can bother the poor creatures. In other words, the divine will is trying to shake us up to think. Because it is right that since they keep a divine will crucified and always in the rattle of agony, the divine will calls them with its writhing, unable to do otherwise because it does not have dominion. Who knows whether entering themselves in seeing the unhappiness that their bad will has produced, that they might change. There's a take on how human beings are unhappy and can't actually interpret it. And so in the second paragraph, the Lord tells us that the teachers of last resort are sorrow and suffering. In other words, we get a taste of what the divine will has. And again, it's trying to bring us around. So paragraph one is the divine will agonizing within us. Paragraph two, we see the divine will agonizing on Calvary. And in paragraph three, the divine will agonizing in nature. And therefore, nature actually begins to punish us. It's actually very interesting the way this is done. So the second paragraph, the agony of my will is so painful that my humanity, which wanted to suffer it in the Garden of Gethsemane, reached the point of seeking help from my very apostles. And even that I didn't get. And the spasm was such that I sweated living blood. And feeling myself succumbing under the enormous weight of the agony of my divine will, which he was suffering on behalf of the rest of us, so long and terrible, I invoked the help of my celestial Father, saying to him, Father, if it be possible, let this chalice pass from me. In all the other pains of my passion, as atrocious as they were, I never said, if it be possible, let it pass. On the contrary, on the cross I cried out, I thirst for pains. But in this pain, the agony of the supreme will, I felt all the weight of an agony that is of 6,000 years. All the torment of a divine will that agonizes, that writhes in the human generations. There is no sorrow that can equal this. I want to give you Lamentations chapter 1, verses 12 and 18. So the response to this is that nature, which has the divine will operating in it so that it even exists, picks up the agony of God and expresses it in the violence of nature. It's very, very interesting. That's why I want you to look at that program, When the Earth is Angry. Now, think of the 21st century and where we're at right now as I'm reading this. Now, the supreme fiat wants to get out. It's tired, and at any cost it wants to get out of this agony so prolonged. So if you hear of chastisements, of cities collapsed, of destructions, this is nothing other than the strong writhing of the agony of the divine will. And they're going on and on about climate change. They don't know what's going on at all. Unable to bear it any longer, the divine will wants to make the human family feel its painful state and how it rides strongly within them without anyone having the least compassion for it. And making use of violence, you see, somebody in desperate agony, in desperate pain, does use violence. Making use of violence with its writhing, it wants them to feel that the divine will does in fact exist in them. But it doesn't want to be in agony anymore. It wants freedom. It wants dominion. It wants to carry out its life in them, "What disorder there is in society, my daughter," he said, "because my will doesn't reign. All the disorder comes from the human will." Their souls are like houses without order. Everything is upside down. The stench is so horrible, more than a putrefied cadaver. And my will, with its immensity, such that it is not given to it to withdraw even from the heartbeat of a creature. So the Lord is involved in every cell of our bodies. He agonizes in the midst of so many evils. And this happens in the general order of all, but in the particular order then it's even worse. That means, first of all, the general order is society. The particular order are the clergy and religious. And finally, the third one is the laity. In other words, there's chaos everywhere. The laity are those who call themselves Catholics. But my will not only agonizes, but it's kept in a state of lethargy. Now, this is a very big insight, I think, to what's wrong in the church today. Lethargy is one of the symptoms of sepsis. And it is that a person, they're sleepwalking. They can't think. They can't decide. They can't work. They can't do anything. And it's this state that the church is asleep, as if it had no life. Oh, how much harder, Jesus said, this is. It's actually easier to convert somebody who's angry than somebody who's in lethargy, because at least the anger says the person is alive. In fact, in the agony, at least I writhe. I have an outlet. I make myself heard as existing in them, even though agonizing. But in the state of lethargy, there is total immobility. And that is what is described in Jesus' existence in his mother's womb, in that book, Our Blessed Mother in the Divine Will. His immobility, this terrible state of not being able to do anything. He says it's a continuous state of death. Now, since the beginning of volume 20, Louisa has been continuously repairing for the church. As she says herself, dying and not dying. Dying and not being able to die. And in this terrifying agony that she doesn't understand. But once this is explained, you do understand it. And so Jesus said, only the appearances, in other words, the church is asleep, only the appearances, the clothing of religious life can be seen, because they keep my will in lethargy. And because they keep it in lethargy, look how often this word is repeated. Because of that, their interior is drowsy, as if the light, the good, were not actually for them. So I want to give you Luke chapter 22, verses 45 and 46. It's also in Mark, I think it's chapter 13, where Jesus tells the apostles to, for God's sake, stay awake. Stay awake and pray. Don't sleep. The church mustn't sleep. The church must stay awake. And of course, the church is the clergy, the religious, and the laity. It's not one of them. It's all of us. And then he says, if they, that is the members of the church, do anything externally, it's empty of divine life and resolves into the smoke of vainglory, self-esteem and pleasing other creatures. There's the human will in full operation for you. And I, by my supreme volition, while being inside, I go out of their works. Now, I want to give you Ezekiel chapters 10 and 11, where when the people of God in the Old Testament failed the Lord like this, that the Spirit of God actually rose up from the temple and left the city. But the Spirit of God actually came back when they repented. So in the final paragraph, it's a bit heavy for a Christmas present, isn't it? That our choice is to know God by way of love or by way of justice. And it seems that the human race seems to choose the way of justice. So he says, my daughter, what an affront. How I would want everyone to feel my tremendous agony and the continuous rattle, the lethargy in which they put my will. Now, if we had time, I haven't got it because I'm over the time. In the whole of volume 20, the Lord has been saying that the divine will is in a continuous act of continuous giving. And that we have to enter into that. But if the church goes into lethargy and our souls go into lethargy, we're blocking that. And he's saying it's a divine agony for him not to be allowed to do those continuous acts. That we have this frightening power to block God from his work. So the lethargy in which they put my will, because they want to do their own will, that's what puts it into lethargy. Okay. They do not want to let the divine will reign, and they don't want to know the divine will. So this is man living on the earth, thinking that there's nothing there, only earth, and living only with his head down. And this is why the divine will wants to burst its banks with its writhing, so that if they do not want to know the divine will and receive it by ways of love, they may know it by divine justice. Now, we've done the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation explains all this and why it is that divine justice has to take over in what is called the tribulation, which we're entering into. And the tribulation is going to be terrible. So, tired of the agony of centuries, my will wants to get out. And therefore, it prepares two ways. Number one, the triumphant way, which are the knowledge that he reveals to us, the prodigies that he reveals to us, and all the good that is in the kingdom of the supreme fiat. That is the study of the 36 volumes that enables us to enter into the divine will. He said, that's the way he wants. And by the great goodness of God, that's the road we're on. But he said the other one is the way of justice for those who don't want to let the divine will be triumphant. And it's up to the creatures themselves to choose which way they want to go. Notice the responsibility that we have. We can either turn the divine will into a servant or we can let him be king. We are the ones to let him be king. So thank you for listening.